Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. As we near the end of the first week of Phase 2, more and more businesses are opening around Massachusetts. But that, of course, means that more workers are going back to their jobs. What does it mean for employees when we're still in the midst of a pandemic? We're going to spend the first part of our show today focused on workers' rights, how to know if your employer is doing enough to keep you safe, and what you can do if you feel uncomfortable about the situation you're in. So call us. Are you going back to work? Have you been there all along? Do you feel safe? Have you questions about your rights? Call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll see what we can do to answer those questions. Here to help answer those questions is Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. AG Healey, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Good afternoon.
So, AG Healey, the point of today's conversation is worker safety as we reopen during a pandemic. That is where we're going to focus. I know you know, though, there's another massive story going on all around us, which is nationwide renewed attention on race-based police brutality in the wake of the killing of George Floyd. Protests in every state, increased calls for police accountability and reform. So briefly, before we dive into our focus on workers' rights and safety, how are you thinking about this other moment we're also in right now?
Well, this is an incredibly pivotal moment for our country. And what we've seen is this, I think, continued call for justice and equality. That is not going away. I think you're going to continue to see protests and vigils. And I think what we need to do as a country is confront 400 years of racism. We have to own it. We have to acknowledge it. And we have to build forward from this time, beginning by engaging in difficult conversations and listening to Black people and building what we need to build in terms of policy reforms and so many measures to eradicate systemic racism that really pervades all aspects of society, certainly criminal justice, but also housing, employment, education, the environment, really touches everything. And this is the opportunity to build and go forward and do what we should have done as a country a long time ago. I mean, these are about these protests. And what you see is the pain and the anguish of generations of people who have withstood degradation and denigration far too long. And they every day are confronting racism. I opened up a conversation in my office 2 weeks ago, and it's been amazing to have an office-wide conversation with on this topic. And, you know, I think that myself and many of our white colleagues have learned so much listening to the stories of our Black colleagues, what they go through, the ways in which they have been profiled, going into work, pulled over, leaving from work. The ways they've had to instruct and talk to their kids about racism and how to engage with the police, it's really heartbreaking. And so I've just been encouraging everybody, particularly white people, to get as educated as you can on systemic racism, speak up to it and speak out against it, get involved and support community organizations that are fighting this, and really get engaged in this movement.
I appreciate you touching on it with us. I want to acknowledge that there is so much more to talk about here, including responsibilities of institutions like the one that you run in advancing reforms. I hope you will come back on our air soon to dive more deeply into this equally important conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just close on this by saying that a number of us state attorneys general are calling for Congress right now to give us as states authority to investigate patterns and practices of police brutality, unconstitutional policing. We're working very hard with Congresswoman Presley's office, Senator Warren, Senator Harris, and I really hope we can see that change because clearly we don't have a Justice Department that's going to do anything about this. And state AGs really need to be given that authority by Congress. But
great.
A lot
so
to
we'll
talk
have
about
you
for
back
sure.
on. Yeah, we'll have you back on. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. I do want to turn our attention to today's critical subject. What do you think is the most important thing for workers across the state to know as more businesses open and more workers head back to their place of employment?
That they need to be safe and protected. You know, as we reopen, there are very clear mandates for what has to happen in the workplace. Employees need to feel safe and they need to be protected when they return to work. Obviously, we want to see the reopening. We need to see the reopening. But, you know, my office, which runs a Fair Labor Division, created a hotline because already we've had reports of workers reporting to work in unsafe working conditions. We've been able to take action with those employers and make that right. But it is really important for employees to know that they have rights, regular cleaning and disinfection, the right PPE, personal protective equipment, 6 feet of social distancing, and there can be no requiring a symptomatic employee to work. You can't force somebody to work if they're sick, nor can you retaliate against a worker who is out for COVID-19 related illness. So we're now in phase two, and I think Governor Baker's phase plan requires really important things, and as Attorney General, we're going to be there to enforce that.
So our lines are filling up quickly, and there's another voice that I want to bring in on this. But before we do, I have one other question to ask you. You mentioned PPE a moment ago. I want to ask you about a story we aired today on BUR about acquiring masks and other PPE. We've seen mask prices go up sometimes 1,000%. We've also seen that some of the masks purchased by the state or by hospitals turn out to not meet important standards. You've spoken to WBUR about the state's scramble to get masks and other PPE during the pandemic, and I know your office is investigating some distributors. Any updates or reactions to that that you want to share?
Well, just that we continue to be very vigilant. You know, immediately we put out an emergency regulation to ban price gouging because we saw the really crazy markup in price for masks, gowns, other supplies. There has been this real fight. There's been a tremendous worldwide demand out there, and supply chains have definitely been affected. So, you know, I'm just hoping that we as a state can continue to work to support employers, to support schools, to support daycares, you know, to support our hospitals, nursing homes, and the like, who are going to continue to need PPE for months to come. But it is it's certainly exposed some of the weaknesses in the system, that's for sure.
So, Attorney General Healy, we're going to bring an additional voice in for more on workers' rights as the state continues to reopen. We're also joined by Judith Miller, a labor attorney and founder of Miller Employment Law Group in Newton, Massachusetts. Judy, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
And Judy, before we go to calls, let me just ask you to add to the conversation what you've been hearing from workers, because I'm sure you have, about what it's been like for them to return to work. What kind of concerns are you hearing?
The concerns fall into two categories. The first category is generally, and this dovetails with what Attorney General Healy was saying, employees who are worried about returning to work, worried about, particularly if they're in a high-risk group, worried about their ability to be protected when they return to work. I've had a number of situations where employees have gone to their employers and said, I am in a high-risk category. What can we do to make my workplace safer? And the employer has said, well, then you can't come back to work. The other thing that I'm concerned about, and this happened during the last recession, is that this is a time where employers start to prune their workplaces. They're nervous that they're not going to be able to afford all their employees. And unfortunately, what I see happening is the first people to go are people for whom there is implicit bias, like Black people, older people, those protected categories. People in those categories I see getting cut, getting laid off more frequently than the rest of the workforce.
So let me turn to Attorney General Healy to just address that last point, and then our lines are completely full, so I'll start getting us to some callers as well. On that last point, AG Healy.
Well, I think that, you know, which last point, the
the part about employers first turning to protected populations for layoffs
right.
in this
Judith
moment.
Is absolutely right. I mean, we they are the first to go, and you know, unfortunately, they are so vulnerable anyways. And so, you know, we are aware of that. We are again, I opened up a Fair Labor hotline in my office for any complaints of retaliation or if you hear you've been unfairly terminated. And I just, you know, again, I call on the business community to try to work together as best we can to, you know, keep jobs for people. Some people have been able to take advantage of the PPP program. I know some haven't been, but part of the aim of that federal stimulus money was to allow employers to keep employees on their payroll during this time. And now, obviously, as we're returning to work and reopening, you know, we hope that employers will have an even greater capacity to do that. It's been a hard situation for employers and a real hard situation for employees.
All right, let's turn to some calls. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your question. We've got Jane on the line from Brookline. Jane, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm calling because I'm a preschool teacher, and as our schools plan to reopen this week, I've noticed a huge problem with a lack of childcare for preschool teachers themselves, with either children enrolled at the school or at a neighboring school or in the public school systems. And, you know, I understand that under the CARES Act that each employee is entitled or is covered for 80 hours of to care for a child if the child care center is not open. But what protections or, you know, resources do employees have that may need to go to work and open the schools if their child's school is not open? And what extra precautions can the state do to help preschool teachers when they're already in such a vulnerable situation, given the fact that, you know, in an infant toddler classroom, there's no keeping 6 feet of distance. You know, as a child care provider, we understand that. We want to provide developmentally appropriate.
Excuse me for interrupting you, but we have lots of calls, and I do want to get an answer to your call. So let me come back to our panel and see if either of our panelists has an answer they'd like to give you there.
Go ahead, Judy. Thank you. Under the CARES Act, I can answer part of it, which is under the CARES Act, there's a provision for leave, not just for 80 hours, but also continuing leave if there is no child care that is open. So while the other child care centers are beginning to open, if you don't have child care, you can go to your employer and talk about a leave beyond the 2 week period.
Attorney General Healy, is there any more that you want to add to that?
I think that Jane is making a really excellent point and something that I've heard from a lot of people about. We need to, as a state, figure out child care now. We simply cannot reopen in the way people think about reopening, whether you're a school teacher or you're working in a company downtown. We cannot effectively reopen until and unless we figure out child care and also education. We have to start with our young people. And already during the last 2 months, we've seen this on parents. I know I had many folks in my office have children who are at home, and the strain of both, you know, having to work and care for them. Those who are teachers having to think of their classrooms, but also take care of their own kids. So we need a huge concentrated effort from the state level on this. This is going to be the top priority right now, in my view. And we haven't done enough, I think, as a state on this. We need to do more. We need a plan, and we need it now. And we're going to need boatloads of money for these child care centers, and it's got to be figured out.
All right, let's turn to our next call. 800-423-8255 is the number. We have Alexander on the line from Roslindale. Alexander, what's your question?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Basically, my wife and I are both laid off restaurant servers, and while we are very concerned about all the PPE, of course, she's 8 months pregnant. We're expecting our first child in July. Safety is a big concern as a high-risk population, but we're really concerned about our financial situation. With the $600 extra benefit ending at the end of July, as McConnell promises, We will be down to half of what we're living on now, which puts us in a full-blown emergency, let alone, and this is the real question, we're already getting pressure to come back to work, and we don't know what rights we have to refuse it. If we refused and lost that as well, I don't even know how to describe where we would be at with a new baby and zero money coming in because we refuse to go put ourselves at risk at an empty restaurant. And that's the further point, which maybe is not an attorney general question about rights, but a practical part is those are empty restaurants. Like, how many servers could you even keep, right, on a busy
night
when
it's closed down? So let's
turn it back over. You cut servers. So, yeah, sure.
Yep. Yeah, let's get that answer. And Alexander, I'm sorry for your stressful situation. And I also hope that it's a safe, healthy delivery for you. And I think you were asking Attorney General Maura Healey. So let's turn to her first there.
Well, sure. Look, and I echo those sentiments as well, Alexander. I hope everything goes well for you. Now, you know, I totally hear what you're saying. And let me tell you this. If you are at high risk for complications of COVID, you can request an accommodation, such as the ability to telework or work in a more isolated area. That's not going to necessarily work for you as a server. But the governor's reopening plan, as I understand it, does instruct employers to offer high-risk workers priority consideration for workplace accommodations. If you feel you've been denied that, you can call my civil rights division. I'm sure that Judith would have other things to offer on this, but, you know, one thing that's been particularly hard for restaurants is that, you know, they haven't been able to actually get a lot of the PPP money. Their hands have been tied, and, you know, most of their employees have been better off collecting unemployment right now. And, you know, as you say, as you live, that's not enough, and it's running out. So we really feel for you, and we really need to find ways to get workers and families like yours the help that they need in the coming months.
And listeners, we will get and post the number to the Attorney General Civil Rights Division on our website at radioboston.org. Judy, is there more you want to add there for Alexander's question before we go to the next caller?
Yeah, I think that it's really important. And I advise, you know, all employees I talk to about this, talk to your employer. If you're not feeling safe in the way in which they have, you know, set up the restaurant or provided PPE, talk to your employer, get them to do more, work with them, tell them your concerns, and talk to them about your high risk. It's really important to let them know you're in a high risk category and you're entitled to these accommodations.
Let's take another question here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Tom on the line from Ashland. Tom, go ahead.
Hi. I'm self-employed and qualified for and began receiving PUA benefits over a month ago, which saved me from dire poverty. But since the allegations of fraud came up, benefits have been frozen. And it's been going on for 4 weeks now. When I first called the department, I was told I had already been confirmed as a real person and to wait a few days. But that was well over a week ago. When I called 2 days ago to find out why the holdup continues, I was told, and I quote, "We don't know for sure why the system is taking long to process the payment," unquote. And, quote, "Nobody has any idea how long it's going to take," unquote. Now, a friend of mine
that sounds very frustrating, Tom,
called their state senator's office and pretty much got the same answer. They're getting told the same thing by the Department of Unemployment. Maybe your office can do something.
Yeah, I hear you.
Great question.
It's ironic. I got a call this morning from a woman in Worcester. She's a single mom and same situation. She'd gotten the PUA payments. All of a sudden she stopped getting them because of, I guess, this issue. My office, I will tell you, is looking at it. I think it's outrageous. I mean, we have to, at a minimum, the Division of Unemployment Assistance needs to right now put out a notice to people who were receiving PUA and say, hey, here's the deal. There was a fraud. We have to go through X, Y, and Z.
And they better be working double time to make sure that the system is fit to allow the continued processing of PUA payments. I just found out about it. My team's told me that we've gotten a ton of complaints about it. There are thousands of cases where benefits have stopped flowing to claimants who need this money. So DUA needs to figure this out now and needs to get this money flowing to people like you right away. So we'll be pushing on this.
Judy, we're going to turn to another call in a minute, but before we do, I want to ask you a quick question. You had told Alexander to talk to his employer, explain his situation. There will also be a role for customers to play in being aware of what the safety standards are, participating in them, and saying something if safety standards aren't being upheld. The governor has said if you see violations, start by reaching out to your local board of health or local government. Is that an effective approach, and is that what you would advise people?
That is a really good question. I think that we have to test that. I think that the local boards of health may not be, depending on the municipality you're in, capable of that, particularly in the employment situation, because in terms of employment, you have, worker safety is a bit different from what the boards of health generally, the issues that they generally deal with. Some of the boards of health in smaller towns are volunteer. And so I think it's going to be a really challenging situation. The problem is we really need to rely on ourselves. And this is a really important issue that the governor needs to, in a sense, focus on, because the federal government is not helping us. I read yesterday that OSHA has gotten 5,000 COVID-related complaints and issued citations in one. So we need to really, as a commonwealth, work together on this.
Yeah.
So, AG Healy, I'm sure you have
everything that Judith said. I would also add that we have a Fair Labor Hotline. The number is 617-727-3465. Workers and customers can report unsafe working conditions to our office. We have, in the last few weeks, reached out to boards of health for them to take action, and they have responded. We also have reached out directly to employers, and they've taken action. So I would just note that's available as a resource as well.
Yeah, that,
and we'll post that number on our website as well. So we have less than 3 minutes left. I want to bring up a question from a caller. I don't have time to go to the caller, but I think this is for you, Attorney General Healy. The caller was from Lexington and said that their town meeting is virtual this year, but they don't have the internet, so they can't participate virtually. Is there a voting rights issue there?
That's really interesting. I would, if you could, get that person's number, and I will have my Division of Open Government look into that. Certainly, we've had to move to these virtual worlds right now, but participation and the ability for one to participate is absolutely imperative. And, that goes for things like public meetings. It goes to education. It goes to any number of realms. So if we could, Tiziana, take the number and the name, and my team will get right back to them.
Yeah, we can do that, definitely. And as soon as we take this offline. All right. And one more question. Again, I'm not going to go to the caller. I'm just going to bring Anne's question forward. Anne from Essex says, can money go to pay unemployed people to look after children? So can we use money we're receiving to pay people who are unemployed to look after children? Yeah, I'm not even sure who to steer that question to. It sounds like neither of you have a ready answer to it.
I'm not sure.
Okay, let's let that one go. I probably needed to have Anne on the line in order to be able to get it answered.
I think it does depend on, I think I want to understand the circumstance. Take Anne's number, and our Fair Labor team will call her back.
Perfect. Thanks so much. All right. We're out of time for any more calls, but I do want to ask Attorney General Healy, as we move further along in phase three is actually potentially quite soon. What are the biggest things that you're going to be watching for?
Well, I think workplace safety. It's really important that we not risk going backwards by allowing for unnecessary infection spread. I think, we have to be flexible with our businesses and employers. That's also meant changing some of the permitting, the zoning, you know, allowing some businesses to operate in new and different ways. You see the delivery of or the ability for curbside pickup of alcohol, for example. That was a change, but again, something necessary in terms of the restaurant's ability to keep running. So, you know, we're going to be looking for opportunities to help workplaces as well as workers, and we are going to keep our eye on workplace safety.
All right, that's Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
And Labor Attorney Judith Miller, founder of Miller Employment Law Group in Newton. Judy, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
As we just heard, lots of folks are trying to figure out what phase two reopening means for them, their families, their jobs, their businesses. Throughout the shutdown, small businesses and restaurant owners have struggled to find a balance that protects their employees, their customers, and their bottom line. As Rob Anderson, co-owner and chef at Provincetown's The Canteen, put it in The Atlantic magazine, quote, "I run a restaurant in a seaside town. I'm not an epidemiologist, but I'm forced to make what could be life and death decisions with little official support," end quote. Rob joins us now. Rob Anderson, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So Rob, just tell us briefly about The Canteen and how it fits into the community of Provincetown.
Sure, so The Canteen has been open. We're heading into our eighth summer season right now. We are a counter service restaurant that serves classic New England food, but sort of with a updated twist to everything. So we have everything from lobster rolls and fish and chips, but also our most popular sandwich is a cod banh mi. We are a year-round restaurant, so we are sort of an anchor in the community. We are very, very busy in the summer, and then we're, you know, a lot quieter in the winter months. But we're happy to be sort of a year-round solid presence throughout the entire year for everybody.
So, of course, that was disrupted by the coronavirus pandemic. You've been takeout only up until now through the pandemic, but phase two, the reopening, you're going to reopen for curbside tomorrow. Is that right?
Well, we've been, since the pandemic, we've been open every single day. We transitioned 2.5 months ago to curbside and delivery only.
Outdoor seating.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And we've been we also opened up a grocery store in our restaurant, doing a delivery service for folks who didn't want to go to the grocery store. And we've been providing sort of a food pantry free groceries to folks here in town that need the economic assistance. So tomorrow, we will be opening up for our outdoor dining for the first time, and we're in the process of getting ready for that right now. Yeah.
Is it going to work? Are you worried about whether it's sufficient volume and whether you can meet guidelines and whether you can keep everyone safe?
Yeah, we're terrified. We're terrified and we're worried and we're anxious. We don't know what to expect. We are trying to strike this balance between keeping everything safe for ourselves, for our families, for our community, for our guests, but at the same time welcoming people so that folks can still enjoy some normalcy and that we can keep our economy moving along. And striking that balance has been particularly difficult, and we just don't know what to expect. We don't know what to prepare for. I start hiring for my summer staff the September the previous year. At this time of the summer, I usually have about 40 to 60 employees working for me. Right now I have 12. So I don't know if I should be hiring more people or if I bring people on. They have to quarantine for 2 weeks and then they would start working. So I need about a month to sort of bring more people on, but I don't know how busy I'm going to be in a month. I don't know if I'm going to be slammed or empty. I have no idea. So taking all these,
what has P-Town been like, Rob? So to that point, you don't know if you're going to be busy. You don't know if you're going to be slammed. You know, has the summer season entered full force? Are you seeing fewer people in general? Tell us a little about that.
It's been very slow. Yeah. So heading into Memorial Day weekend, we didn't know how busy it was going to be. So we sort of prepped to a certain level, expected a certain level of visitors, and they haven't really come. It's been pretty slow. But we're used to having slow weeks during June. The weekends are usually busy, So this will be the first weekend that outdoor dining is available, and there's supposed to be good weather this weekend. So this weekend should be a test of how busy we'll be for the summer, but things don't get really busy and slammed until the 4th of July weekend out here.
You know, you lamented about not being an epidemiologist, but having to make these decisions. And you said in that Atlantic piece that up until this week, so many other businesses, other restaurant owners like you, have been left to figure out what's safe on their own. The state now has guidance for restaurants. Is the guidance sufficient, and is it doable for you?
The guidance, so I appreciate how hard everyone is working. I appreciate that the guidance now exists, and I know everybody is doing their best to try to work through a difficult situation, but the guidance is still, it's coming very late. You know, they gave us 3 days. They gave us the guidelines 3 days before they allowed us to open for outdoor seating. So when you have an institution like a restaurant, think about whatever job you have, whether it's a radio station or if you're an accountant somewhere, think about how difficult it is to change everything you do in a matter of days, you know, adding new guidelines. Like whenever you make a change into an institution, it takes a lot of work. It's training people, it's understanding them, it's reading them properly, it's communicating it to your guests. So I'm happy to have the guidelines. The guidelines are a little thick and hard to sort of wrap your heads around, but we also need the time to implement those guidelines. So that's building barriers, moving tables, getting tables out of storage, moving them back, putting in new health precautions, putting in new, all these different sort of precautions, communicating those to guests. And then we need a week or so to sort of try them out and iron out the kinks. So we're still in the middle of that. And so we're in sort of that stressful process right now. And obviously we're happy to be doing it. We want to be opening up in the safest way we can. So we're in the middle of it, but it's going to land us like right in the middle. We're going to be ready for people like the day before 4th of July. And we don't know if there's going to be a crush of people that day or it's going to be empty. We just don't know.
All right. And that's Rob Anderson, chef and co-owner of the Canteen in the heart of Provincetown. Canteen will reopen outdoor seating tomorrow. Rob, thanks for being with us. We wish you luck tomorrow.
Thanks so much.
From Jackie Robinson to Adam Jones to Tori Hunter, there is a long history of allegations of racism against the Red Sox organization and its fans. Last night, the team issued a statement acknowledging racist incidents with fans and revealing there were 7 reported incidents of fans using racist slurs at Fenway Park last year. The Sox said, quote, "Those are just the ones we know about," end quote. What do you think? We are grappling much more openly right now with race in America. Where does the story of Red Sox fans and racism fit in? Have you seen or experienced racism at Fenway Park? Did anyone do anything about it? What should the Sox do about it now? We want to hear from you. Call us and join this conversation. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Joining us now to have this discussion is Howard Bryant. Howard is senior writer for ESPN, sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, and author of 9 books, including Shutout, A Story of Race and Baseball in Boston. Howard, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. It is great to have you back, Howard. Listen, before we dive in, I do want to put this Red Sox statement in context. Last week, 5-time All-Star Tori Hunter opened up about his experiences of racism at Fenway on ESPN Radio. I just want to play a little bit of that, Howard. Let's listen.
I've been called the N-word in Boston 100 times, and I said something about it. You know, and, oh, he's just a militant. He's lying. This didn't happen. No, it happened all the time from little kids. And grown-ups right next to him didn't say anything. You know, but you know what? Don't say anything. So I had a no-trade clause in everything I had not to go to Boston. Because if you're doing that and allowing it amongst the people, I don't want to be there.
So, Howard, let me just start by asking you, what was your first reaction when you heard that from Tori Hunter?
Well, my reaction was, yeah, it made perfect sense. He's not the first. Obviously, Adam Jones said it after him, and Gary Sheffield and a lot of players who played Red Sox, who were on the Red Sox, who dealt with this. But I also think it's important to remember, too, that the organization handled this very well. I don't know if I'm completely surprised by it based on how they handled Adam Jones as well, but this is the battle. And I think that the Red Sox are in a in a really interesting position where you've got the owner, John Henry, that he has wanted to completely remake what this organization was in terms of its attitudes and reputation, and he has over the past 20 years. But at the same time, you're also dealing with a fan base that is very well known for being pretty hostile. Not that it's the only city in that's hostile, but for fans to say, well, we're not the only ones is not quite the defense you're looking for.
Yeah. So let's ask listeners again, what do you think of the Red Sox response last night, or have they made progress, do you believe, in how they're handling racism at Fenway Park in the last 10 years, the last 20 years? And again, do you have experience with it in the park, sitting in the stands? And if so, what are your thoughts about that? 800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Howard, how would you characterize the Red Sox response, that statement last night? And I'm assuming that's what you mean when you say you think the organization handled it well.
Well, I was talking about a couple things. I was talking about how they dealt with the Adam Jones situation and also their statement last night. Their statement, they volunteered it. And I thought that they could have easily said nothing. They weren't say anything. Obviously, this idea of race and the Red Sox is something that goes all the way back to the 40s. So it's not like what said was anything new. But I really appreciated the fact that they came out, that they stood tall on it, and that they took it head on. When I was a kid growing up in Dorchester, we never even went to Fenway Park. And I remember talking to my uncle about it. I remember talking to family members. And they would always say things like, well, why would I go to a place where I know I'm going to get beat up? I mean, everybody knew the reputation of Fenway Park. We knew that if you went there, especially in the bleachers, you were probably going to get into a fight or had the chance to get into a fight. It wasn't any different than going to Savin Hill or going to any other part of Dorchester or Boston where you were going to be in some trouble. But I think that when John Henry bought that team in January of 2002, he has really committed. And I see more Red Sox hats. I see more Red Sox fans that are of color in Boston than I've seen in my entire life.
So I want to ask you, you talked about Adam Jones. You mentioned him a couple of times, just for listeners who may not know. He's an Orioles player. It was 2017. He said he heard racist taunts from the stands at Fenway, and that one of the fans threw a bag of peanuts at him. First, Howard, just quickly tell our listeners, how did the Red Sox handle that particular complaint from Adam Jones?
Well, the Red Sox put out a statement that was pretty strong, and they actively went out and found the individuals who were accused of what they had done. And I think one of the players got banned. The fans had gotten banned. I think it was a lifetime ban. And so they were strong. And I think that this is like one of those things where I don't think people necessarily are accusing the Red Sox of being a racist franchise. I think what they accuse them of is not doing anything. And this iteration of this organization has certainly done something. To stand up like that is a big deal.
All right. So, you know, I want to talk about that a little bit further. Torrey Hunter told WEEI that before he even played his first game in Fenway, players warned him, just wait till you get to Boston. Now, Hunter played in the John Henry years. So is this a slow ship to turn? And even with the efforts John Henry are making, okay, 2017, Adam Jones is in the field and people are hurling terrible racist taunts at him. 2020, Torrey Hunter saying, lived experience for me repeatedly. Do you understand? I mean, how do we square all that?
Well, I think how you square it is that there's the organization and then there are the people, right? And so I think that when I try to assess an organization, I assess the organization on whether or not it acts and whether or not it's fostering a climate that creates danger. And I think that certainly, I think that the Henry ownership in 2002 has done a much better job of that. I think that they, for all the different reasons, took the name off of Yawkey Way and changed it to Jersey Street. I thought that sent a certain message as well. But I also think that you've got two different issues here. This is about people. This is about the individuals who are coming to that ballpark. And I remember when I was a columnist at the Boston Herald, I never had any issues with the Red Sox, but I had plenty of issues with the readership. So it's, I always sort of wonder to what extent is the team responsible for its clown? And like I said before, my attitude is whether or not, like when I've criticized the Red Sox, it's usually either been on hiring, it's been on lack of action. And when it comes to the fans, I sort of deal with the fans directly myself.
So I want to talk about the sports dimension of this a little bit more. I want to circle back to Torrey Hunter saying that having had such bad experiences at Fenway, despite the fact that he kind of always wanted to play for the Sox, he actually put a no-trade clause in his contracts, which basically said, you can't trade me to the Boston Red Sox. From a baseball standpoint, put that in context. How big a deal is that?
Well, it's a conspiracy against, I mean, how are you going to win ball games if the best players in the game don't want to play for you? And that's one of the battles that that team has had. Ever to the Bambino, when they talked about all these, about the bad luck of not winning, but the biggest way to not win ball games is if the best players aren't coming to you. And Torrey Hunter wasn't the first. David Justice had a no trade clause. Gary Sheffield had a no trade clause. Kirby Puckett had a no trade clause. A lot of players had no trade clauses. In fact, one of the players, Ellis Burks, in 1987, when he was a rookie with the Red Sox, the best player on the team and probably the best black player who's ever played for the Red Sox, Jim Rice, told him, get your 6 years and then get the hell out of them. So everybody knew what the reputation was. I think that one of the problems, to me at least, what was really difficult, it was a financial decision among all kinds of other decisions, and I think time will tell. But I'm interested in hearing what Mookie Betts one day has to say about his time in Boston if you really want to find out about progress and if progress is being made.
So let's stay on that subject for a minute, because as Torrey Hunter told his story, and we've heard this with other black players who have told stories about Fenway Park, there is a, in conversations on sports radio and with journalists, there's this subtle pushback of, well, then why do we have black players who are happy to play here? Almost as if it's not true. And there seems to be a real desire to deny that these experiences are real experiences that are really happening. But jump in. Go.
Yeah, I was going to say, of course there is, because they're defending the team. They're not defending the player. They don't really care what the black player has to say, just like anytime somebody talks about race in Boston or race in anywhere, they immediately sort of try to step on you. As I always say, there are only two ways to talk about race in the United States. One is things are better than they were, and the other is get over it. I certainly don't expect and have never expected fans to respond to these allegations of the player by saying, hey, you're right, we need to be better, because if that were the case, then this place would be better. We wouldn't be in the situation that we're in right now. What I can say, however, is that the organization did shift. These are not the same, it's not the same organization as with the Yankees, I can tell you that much. And so the Red Sox organization, and once again, this is what I mean, Tiziana, that I believe it's two separate issues. I think it would be an even worse conversation if Torrey Hunter said this and the Red Sox were the ones who came out and defended the fans, or if the Red Sox came out and said that Adam Jones didn't know what he was talking about, or if the organization did that. But the organization didn't do that. I think that the Red Sox are in a really, really difficult spot. They're trying to do the right thing, and they seem committed to doing the right thing. But Boston's a tough town. Boston is also one of those places where you're going to get a lot of pushback and a lot of vocal pushback. And the biggest place of concern that I had for the Red Sox has always been, and where I do blame them, has been it's their flagship radio station, which has done as much to foment racism in Boston as any other outlet over the last several years.
So that's an interesting point, because this conversation is not happening in a vacuum. In fact, you were on, you know, with us on Week in Review last Friday, where we were talking pretty deeply about the protests of the previous 2 weeks and the burgeoning movement to defund the police, et cetera. I saw a segment on CNN last week where black reporters were telling stories of the discrimination they've experienced on the job. And I found myself thinking that segment probably wouldn't have aired at this time last summer. So is there room now for black professionals, whether it's in sports or journalism, to be open and heard about their stories of regular and systemic discrimination in a way that we haven't been talking about it until now?
Well, sure, and up to a point. And once again, it all depends on the outlet. Who has the lens? Who has the control? Who gets to do the talking? There are some places that are going to welcome you to talk, and then there are others that aren't. I used to have this conversation with Larry Lucchino fairly often, and Theo Epstein when they were running the team, that if your flagship station is racist and everyone knows it's racist and they make everything and they are the part of the problem, then your efforts are not necessarily going to be rewarded because they get thwarted in on where people hear your team, hear about your team the most. So that's problematic. But once again, I think that we are at this moment in time. It's a very interesting moment in time. And we're watching, as we talked about last week, what are people going to do with it? Not just what are they going to say in their statements and their corporate sloganeering, what are they actually going to do about it? And I always think it's a first step to not deny. We are at our worst when we're denying other people's experiences. And so from the Red Sox side of it, I had no issue with it. But from what Tory said about the fans, 100%, he's not wrong.
So we've got just a couple of minutes left, and I want to take a step back from baseball, Howard, take advantage of your wide experience to put this in a little bit bigger context. Let's compare and contrast this example with, let's say, the NFL. We know Roger Goodell basically admitted that the NFL had made the wrong decision in its response to Colin Kaepernick and his kneeling protests of a few years ago. Does the MLB have a same or different problem at a league level as other professional sports? And how collectively do these major sports franchises need to be thinking about the question of racism right now?
Well, I think everybody does, because we're in this moment, we're in this little special window, and we'll see how long this window lasts. It feels very different from in the past. I'll certainly say that. I think baseball has a different issue. I think baseball's issue is way more cultural. Baseball, one of the things that Adam Jones did say back in 2017 when he was asked after the Colin Kaepernick protest was, well, how come you don't see these same protests in baseball? And he essentially said, because baseball was a white man's sport. So Adam Jones had a lot to say. I think that football obviously is very different, because there's not an industry in the country that I can think of that made its position about kneeling more clear than the National Football League. The National Football League went out of its way to tell everybody how they felt by taking a player's career and essentially destroying it. I mean, they actively went out of their way. It wasn't just words when it came to Colin Kaepernick. And to the point now where now this is what we talk about what are you going to do? The fact that they even, Roger Goodell put out that statement and didn't even mention Colin Kaepernick's name, it really is the equivalent to me of a guy receiving a death sentence, having the DNA exonerate him and leaving him on death row. And this is exactly what the NFL did much, much more forcefully. I think baseball isn't in that situation. Obviously, there's only 68 black players in the game anyway, but I think that baseball's got a different type of inclusion problem, and it's much more it's more class-based in the combination of class and race. But the NFL is the one where they've really, really been hostile.
All right, Howard, we've got like 20 seconds left. The next big thing you're looking for on the question of race in sports right now, what are you looking for?
Action. I'm looking for hiring. I'm looking for a real level of inclusion that goes beyond slogans and words. There are a lot of grievances that people hear. You got to hear them, and you also can't punish people for having their feelings.
That's Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN, sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, and author of 9 books, including Shutout, A Story of Race and Baseball in Boston. Howard, I appreciate you joining us today. Thanks.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wolfman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Jimmy Kiesling. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tisiana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.